Chapter 30. Waited? Waited for the one horse cab? It would scarcely have carried the four of us, do you think? She took this in, what seemed the only possible way, with a laugh intended to sink the question itself in his humorous treatment of it. Well, it would have been difficult. We should have had to walk by turns. But it would have been jolly to see the sunrise. Yes. The sunrise was jolly, he agreed. Was it? You saw it, then? I saw it, yes. From the deck. I waited up for them. Naturally, I suppose you were worried. Why didn't you call on me to share your vigil? He stood still, dragging at his mustache with a lean, weak hand. I don't think you would have cared for its denouement, he said with sudden grimness. Again she was disconcerted by the abrupt change in his tone, and as in one flash she saw the peril of the moment, and the need of keeping her sense of it out of her eyes. Denouement, isn't that too big a word for such a small incident? The worst of it, after all, is the fatigue which Bertha has probably slept off by this time. She clung to the note bravely, though its futility was now plain to her in the glare of his miserable eyes. Don't, he broke out, with the hurt cry of a child, and while she tried to merge her sympathy, and her resolve to ignore any cause for it, in one ambiguous murmur of deprecation, he dropped down on the bench near which they had paused, and poured out the wretchedness of his soul. It was a dreadful hour, an hour from which she emerged shrinking and seared, as though her lids had been scorched by its actual glare. It was not that as he had never had premonitory glimpses of such an outbreak, but rather because, here and there throughout the 3 months, the surface of life had shown such ominous cracks and vapors, that her fears had always been on the alert for an upheaval. There had been moments, when the situation had presented itself under a homelier, yet more vivid image, that of a shaky vehicle, dashed by unbroken steeds over a bumping road, while she cowered within, aware that the harness wanted mending, and wondering what would give way first. Well, everything had given way now, and the wonder was that the crazy outfit had held together so long. Her sense of being involved in the crash, instead of merely witnessing it from the road, was intensified by the way in which Dorset, through his furies of denunciation and wild reactions of self-contempt, made her feel the need he had of her, the places he had taken in his life. But for her, what ear would have been open to his cries? And what hand, but hers, could drag him up again to a footing of sanity and self-respect? All through the stress of the struggle with him, as he had been conscious of something faintly maternal in her efforts to guide and uplift him. But for the present, if he clung to her, it was not in order to be dragged up, but to feel someone floundering in the depths with him. He wanted her to suffer with him, not to help him to suffer less. Happily for both, there was little physical strength to sustain his frenzy. It left him, collapsed and breathing heavily, to an apathy so deep and prolonged that Lily almost feared the passers-by would think it the result of a seizure, and stopped to offer their aid. But Monte Carlo is, of all places, the one where the human bond is least close, and odd sights are the least arresting. If a glance or two lingered on the couple, no intrusive sympathy disturbed them, and it was Lily herself who broke the silence by rising from her seat. With the clearing of her vision, the sweep of peril had extended, and she saw that the post of danger was no longer at Dorset's side. If you won't go back, I must. Don't make me leave you, she urged. But he remained mutely resistant, and she added, Colin, what are you going to do? You really can't sit here all night. I can go to an hotel. I can telegraph my lawyers. He sat up, roused by a new thought. Be by Jove, Selden's at Nice, I'll send for Selden. Lily, at this, reseated herself with a cry of alarm. And no, she protested. He swung round on her distrustfully. Why not Selden? He's a lawyer, isn't he? One will do as well as another in a case like this. As badly as another, you mean? I thought you relied on me to help you. You do by being so sweet and patient with me. If it hadn't been for you, I'd have ended the thing long ago. But now it's got to end. He rose suddenly, straightening himself with an effort. You can't want to see me ridiculous. She looked at him kindly. T, that's just it. Then, after a moment's pondering, almost to her own surprise, she broke out with a flash of inspiration, colon, well, go over and see Mr. Selden. You'll have time to do it before dinner. Oh, dinner, he mocked her, but she left him with a smiling rejoinder, colon, dinner on board. Remember, we'll put it off till 9 if you like. It was past 4 already, and when a cab had dropped her at the quay, and she stood waiting for the gig to put off for her, she began to wonder what had been happening on the yacht. Of Silverton's whereabouts there had been no mention. Had he returned to the Sabrina? Or could Bertha, the dread alternative sprang on her suddenly, could Bertha, left to herself, have gone ashore to rejoin him? Lily's heart stood still at the thought. All her concern had hitherto been for young Silverton, not only because, in such affairs, the woman's instinct is to side with the man, but because his case made a peculiar appeal to her sympathies. He was so desperately in earnest, poor youth, and his earnestness was of so different a quality from Bertha's, though hers too was desperate enough. The difference was that Bertha was in earnest only about herself, while he was in earnest about her. But now, at the actual crisis, this difference seemed to throw the weight of destitution on Bertha's side, since at least he had her to suffer for, and as he had only herself. At any rate, viewed less ideally, all the disadvantages of such a situation were for the woman, and it was to Bertha that Lily's sympathies now went out. She was not fond of Bertha Dorset, but neither was she without a sense of obligation, the heavier for having so little PERP 213 greater than Sona liking to sustain it. Bertha had been kind to her, they had lived together, during the last months, on terms of easy friendship, and the sense of friction of which Lily had recently become aware seemed to make it the more urgent that she should work undividedly in her friend's interest. It was in Bertha's interest, certainly, that as he had dispatched Dorset, to consult with Lawrence Selden. Once the grotesqueness of the situation accepted, as he had seen at a glance, that it was the safest in which Dorset could find himself. Who but Selden could thus miraculously combine the skill to save Bertha with the obligation of doing so? The consciousness that much skill would be required made Lily rest thankfully in the greatness of the obligation. Since he would have to pull Bertha through, she could trust him to find a way, and she put the fullness of her trust in the telegram she managed to send him on her way to the quay. Thus far, then, Lily felt that as he had done well, and the conviction strengthened her for the task that remained. She and Bertha had never been on confidential terms, but at such a crisis the barriers of reserve must surely fall. Dorset's wild allusions to the scene of the morning made Lily feel that they were down already, and that any attempt to rebuild them would be beyond Bertha's strength. She pictured the poor creature shivering behind her fallen defenses and awaiting with suspense the moment when she could take refuge in the first shelter that offered. If only that shelter had not already offered itself elsewhere. As the gig traversed the short distance between the quay and the yacht, Lily grew more than ever alarmed at the possible consequences of her long absence. What if the wretched Bertha, finding in all the long hours no soul to turn to, but by this time Lily's eager foot was on the side ladder, and her first step on the Sabrina showed the worst of her apprehensions to be unfounded. For there, in the luxurious shade of the after deck, the wretched Bertha, in full command of her usual attenuated elegance, sat dispensing tea to the Duchess of Belcher and Lord Hubert. The sight filled Lily with such surprise that she felt that Bertha, at least, must read its meaning in her look, and she was proportionately disconcerted by the blankness of the look returned. But in an instant she saw that Mrs. Dorset had, of necessity, to look blank before the others, and that, to mitigate the effect of her own surprise, she must at once produce some simple reason for it. The long habit of rapid transitions made it easy for her to exclaim to the Duchess, colon, why, I thought you'd gone back to the Princess. And this sufficed for the lady she addressed, if it was hardly enough for Lord Hubert. At least it opened the way to a lively explanation of how the Duchess was, in fact, going back the next moment, but at first rushed out to the yacht for a word with Mrs. Dorset on the subject of tomorrow's dinner, the dinner with the Brys, to which Lord Hubert had finally insisted on dragging them. "To save my neck, you know," he explained, with a glance that appealed to Lily for some recognition of his promptness. And the Duchess added, with her noble candor, "Mr. Bry has promised him a tip, and he says, if we go he'll pass it on to us." This led to some final pleasantries, in which, as it seemed to Lily, Mrs. Dorset bore her part with astounding bravery, and at the close of which Lord Hubert, from halfway down the side ladder, called back, with an air of numbering heads : "And of course we may count on Dorset too?" "Oh, count on him," his wife assented gaily. She was keeping up well to the last, but as she turned back from waving her adieu over the side, Lily said to herself that the mask must drop, and the soul of fear look out. Mrs. Dorset turned back slowly. Perhaps she wanted time to steady her muscles. At any rate, they were still under perfect control when, dropping once more into her seat behind the tea table, she remarked to Miss Bart with a faint touch of irony : "I suppose I ought to say good morning." If it was a cue, Lily was ready to take it, though with only the vaguest sense of what was expected of her in return. There was something unnerving in the contemplation of Mrs. Dorset's composure, and as he had to force the light tone in which he answered : "I tried to see you this morning, but you were not yet up." "No, I got to bed late. After we missed you at the station I thought we ought to wait for you till the last train." She spoke very gently, but with just the least tinge of reproach. "You missed us? You waited for us at the station?" Now indeed Lily was too far adrift in bewilderment to measure the other's words or keep watch on her own. "But I thought you didn't get to the station till after the last train had left." Mrs. Dorset, examining her between lowered lids, met this with the immediate query : "Who told you that?" "George, I saw him just now in the gardens." "Ah, is that George's version?" Poor George, he was in no state to remember what I told him. He had one of his worst attacks this morning, and I packed him off to see the doctor. Do you know if he found him?" Lily, still lost in conjecture, made no reply, and Mrs. Dorset settled herself indolently in her seat. "He'll wait to see him. He was horribly frightened about himself. It's very bad for him to be worried, and whenever anything upsetting happens, it always brings on an attack." This time Lily felt sure that a cue was being pressed on her, but it was put forth with such startling suddenness, and with so incredible an air of ignoring what it led up to, that she could only falter out doubtfully : "Anything upsetting?" "Yes, such as having you so conspicuously on his hands in the small hours. You know, my dear, you're rather a big responsibility in such a scandalous place after midnight." At that, at the complete unexpectedness and the inconceivable audacity of it, Lily could not restrain the tribute of an astonished laugh. "Well, really, considering it was you who burdened him with the responsibility." Mrs. Dorset took this with an exquisite mildness. "By not having the superhuman cleverness to discover you in that frightful rush for the train, or the imagination to believe that you'd take it without us, you and he all alone instead of waiting quietly in the station till we did manage to meet you." Lily's color rose. It was growing clear to her that Bertha was pursuing an object, following a line as he had marked out for herself. Only, with such a doom impending, why waste time in these childish efforts to avert it? The puerility of the attempt disarmed Lily's indignation. Did it not prove how horribly the poor creature was frightened? "No, by our simply all keeping together at nice," she returned. "Keeping together? When it was you who seized the first opportunity to rush off with the Duchess and her friends. My dear Lily, you are not a child to be led by the hand. No, nor to be lectured, Bertha, really, if that's what you are doing to me now." Mrs. Dorset smiled on her reproachfully. I'll lecture you, I? Heaven forbid. I was merely trying to give you a friendly hint. But it's usually the other way around, isn't it? I'm expected to take hints, not to give them. I've positively lived on them all these last months. Hints from me to you? Lily repeated. Oh, negative ones merely what not to be, and to do and to see. And I think I've taken them to admiration. Only, my dear, if you'll let me say so, I didn't understand that one of my negative duties was not to warn you when you carried your imprudence too far. A chill of fear passed over Miss Bart. A sense of remembered treachery that was like the gleam of a knife in the dusk. But compassion, in a moment, got the better of her instinctive recoil. What was this outpouring of senseless bitterness, but the tracked creature's attempt to cloud the medium through which it was fleeing? It was on Lily's lips to exclaim, colon, you poor soul, don't double and turn, come straight back to me, and we'll find a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.